in your possession. Whatever certainty you know. Forget your heroes. You don't really need those last few lessons. Stand in the open. Next voice you hear will be your own. But all right, they knew how they could hurt you, and you let them cut you to the bone. But God forbid you allow them to rid you of your virtue. Forget their laughter. Next voice you hear will be your own.
Next voice you hear will be mine. Good day, Mr. and Mrs. America, and to all the freedom-loving Christians and patriots all across this great republic and around the world, we bid you welcome to another installment of Perspectives on America, chiefly Chapter 4 of our series, Dawn of the Dead. I'm your host for the program and the series, Jeffrey Bennett. You are listening to this program, Dawn of the Dead, in the clutches of the United Nations. Bennett, what's the meaning of that title, I've been asked. We hope that through this six-hour series, that it will in fact become the dawn of the dead. Dead for those who have laid in ignorance and stupidity for so many years about this august, austere organization known as the United Nations. We are in the clutches of the United Nations as we speak in every facet of our life in these United States of America. In the first three episodes, we've discussed some history. We have endeavored to discuss the United Nations designs on a global one-world military. We've discussed the fact that since the advent of the United Nations in 1945, we have faced perpetual war and unending terror. We've discussed the fact that the United Nations is not our friend. We've talked about disarmament of civilians, the United Nations gun grab. And as this series winds down in chapters 5 and 6, we're going to discuss the global tax man, the United Nations attack on world population, the United Nations designs on not only the youth of America, but the youth all over the world to change the way these children think about ecology, about finance, about global domination. And finally, we will conclude in chapter 6 and endeavor to investigate what it might be like to live in this world today without a United Nations. And I say that in terms of the organization. It doesn't mean that nations cannot unite for the common good, the common goal of brothers and sisters all over the world. But this organization, which is the brainchild of communists and socialists and fascists throughout the world, is a poison upon our land. And with that, we will step toward a durable peace. I had mentioned in the past a gentleman, and I mean a gentleman, who I had met some years ago, a man named Ed Balajewski. And I mentioned I'd not talked with Ed in oh so long. I know he's had his battles with cancer and other health-related problems. I know he's also been under pressure by forces that you and I would like not to have to deal with. Some years ago, Ed began to be somewhat of a mentor to me with information. Information that had been handed to him by his mentors. Information he believes should be passed on. Back in those days, we had nothing but the printed word. Now we have the recorded word. And therefore, we hope that the endeavors that we continue to make here at Kettle Moraine and through this broadcast, that this information will act as somewhat of mentorship for others to follow. Some years ago, Ed sent me a number of folders. In one of our earlier installments of this series, we shared one of them. And I'd hope to get back to that which we are about to share with you. Toward a Durable Peace. Subtitle: a famous economist, Eugene Staley, by the way, looks at the war as the generator of a possible world order. Three economic essentials, Mr. Staley begins, of a durable peace may be laid down. Though not sufficient by themselves to ensure a new era of world amity after the war, they are nevertheless indispensable to any long-range democratic efforts that pretends to be realistic. First, political boundaries must be made economically permeable to the extent that national or imperial boundaries are economic walls. Access to the world's markets and materials through peaceful exchange is limited. A certain justification is thus provided for the notion that economic opportunity depends on the extent of a nation's political domain. Secondly, there must be reasonable economic stability. Reasonable economic stability. Disastrous booms and depressions which throw millions of workers out of jobs disappoint the hopes of middle-class enterprisers and investors and create a mental atmosphere of frustration, lay the psychological foundation for nationalistic economic policies and for aggressive political movements. Third, and closely related to the point just made, there must be an atmosphere of progressive economic development in the world. An expanding economy where steady technological improvement and constant increase in the world's capital equipment is combined with a high level of employment makes all sorts of political, social, and economic adjustments relatively easy. A contracting economy makes them doubly difficult. What, author Staley asks, can the United States do now and at the end of the war to create these necessary conditions for durable peace? There are some things that we can do right at home. We are such a large fraction of the whole world, economically speaking, that if we can maintain stability here at a high level of employment, that in itself will be an important contribution to international economic stability, providing we get our high level of employment by constructive means. The constructive means include measures which have the effect of increasing the total volume of effective demand. For example, stimulation of useful public and private investment in housing, urban redevelopment, new industries, river valley development, and the like. They do not include competitive currency depreciation or export-forcing measures or import restrictions, all of which are attempts to help ourselves by grabbing markets away from someone else. Now, at the same time, there are many things that we must be prepared to do in collaboration with other countries. First, relief, reconstruction. Immediately after the war, it will be necessary to send foodstuffs, equipment, and stocks of raw materials into distressed areas. Collaborative efforts will be needed. Comprehensive schemes will cost much less and be more likely to bring the political and economic results we want than stopgap measures such as occasional loans. Secondly, collaboration in anti-depression efforts. Rapid agreement and quick action, particularly with respect to money and credit policies, measures affecting exchange rates between currencies, and public works policies will all be important. Third, we must have development programs. In addition to internal development within the principal industrial countries, in other words, expansion of public and private investment in housing, etc., there should be deliberate collaborative efforts designed to stimulate and maintain a high rate of real investment all over the world in the post-war period. Regional development programs organized under international auspices and with international technical and financial aid, such as China, Latin America, the Balkans, Africa, all of which will be needed. Governments must take the lead. The benefit of a large program for investment of American capital in such countries as China under proper international supervision would be mutual. It would help to give us greater employment and to maintain an expanding economy when a post-war depression threatens, and it would help to level upward living standards throughout the world. If properly controlled by institutions in which the countries under development would play their part, this process need not have the objectionable features of old-style economic imperialism. Fourth, trade. On the negative side, steps must be taken for effectively limiting the economic sovereignty of states so that they will not have the power to restrict trade at national frontiers as they choose. B, on the positive side, international collaboration will be needed for the reduction of trade barriers. But reduction of barriers is not in itself an adequate program. You see, in some important areas, the conditions necessary for effective functioning of a free market economy will not be present. External trade will have to be carried on to a considerable extent by public authorities. Russia, China, Japan, probably most of Europe will have to be reincorporated into a peacetime world economy by more positive methods than simply letting trade flow. We must face realistically the problem of economic collaboration between predominantly capitalist and predominantly socialist countries. The distinction, indeed, had lost much of its sharpness even before the war. And it will be still more blurred after the war. The truth is that all the so-called capitalist countries have been operating for some time under mixed systems. It will be necessary to arrange some specific exchanges of actual goods and services between public or quasi-public authorities. It would be desirable to do this through supranational collaborative agencies, wherever possible, rather than through bilateral national bargains. Fifth, commodity controls. There's that word again, controls. Some kind of supranational regulation of commodity control schemes and cartels would be necessary in order to ensure that price and output policies would be determined with a view to the general public interest and not exclusively by the pressure of producers or in the interest of some area that may enjoy a monopoly. Collaborative arrangements will be needed for the handling of surpluses in commodities of international importance such as cotton, rubber, wheat. But unless such arrangements are to be merely restrictive, they cannot deal exclusively with one commodity at a time. Therefore, it is necessary to have a more comprehensive supervising and coordinating agency of some sort. Adaption in the sense of moving resources out of industries that prove to be overexpanded into diversified production for which demands are created by local and worldwide development must be the new aims of commodity controls. 6. Development of an international labor code. Constant collaboration at the supranational level will be needed in order to level up standards of competition in respect to employment conditions and to further social security. 7. planning of resettlement opportunities and guidance of migration. Under post-war conditions, it will not be feasible simply to remove barriers to migration. The best hope for constructive economic adjustment in this field appears to be carefully planned migration, worked out jointly by national governments and international agencies. 8. Control of colonial policies. All nations, you see, should be guaranteed equal privileges in economic relations with non-self-governing areas. In order to make that guarantee effective, and in order to foster development with due regard to the interests of inhabitants, all colonies should be brought under a universal mandates system, with the exception of some which might better be placed under the direct administration of a supranational agency. For doing these things, may it not be possible to carry over into the peace period the habits and techniques of wartime collaboration now developing among the United Nations? Art not the germs of the future world order to be found not in comprehensive schemes and constitutional blueprints, but in the day-to-day interchanges now going on in Washington, London, Moscow, Beijing, Ottawa, regarding such economic matters as production and allocation of equipment, shipping problems, raw material procurement? The idea that organizationally, as well as in other ways, the peace will grow out of war offers the advantage of gradualness. It offers a process by which a nucleus for future world organization may be cemented together under wartime stress, later to serve as an organizing and power center for a stable world system. It allows flexibility. Concrete problems are attacked by ad hoc methods through instrumentalities which, even if regarded as more or less temporary expedients, may actually become permanent and may take on new functions beyond their original tasks. Many of the steps in this gradual process can be taken by the executive branches of the collaborating governments without special legislation. Even where legislative approval is necessary, it may be possible to center discussion on concrete issues, avoiding to some extent such broad dramatic debates as that of the 1919-1920 over the League of Nations in the United States Senate. Great decisions respecting international collaboration may be built up over years out of hundreds of smaller decisions, like the Anglo-Saxon common law, which broadens down from precedent to precedent. A post-war democratic order may perhaps grow out of concerted attacks on one concrete problem after another. All of this is not to say that we should swallow whole the exaggerated doctrine that wartime collaboration will carry over automatically, or that wartime agencies will be wholly suitable and sufficient for the economic problems that will follow the war. Goals, organizations, and techniques will differ. The efficacy of mere technical collaboration can be overestimated. The fundamental problem is likely to be achievement and maintenance of unity of purpose, unity of will. Neither the structure nor the personnel nor the objects of wartime control are suitable for times of peace. That conclusion by the London Economist in an editorial on Britain's post-war problems. That point of view needs to be taken into account. We need to examine the methods and objects of wartime collaboration. First, coordination of production programs. The problem is to plan the war production programs of the different countries as much as possible as one whole. There must be agreement on such concrete points as the number and type of planes or tanks to be built in each country. Standardization of design, priorities and allocation of scarce materials, delivery dates, the quantities of finished munitions to be allocated to the different theaters of war. Secondly, joint management of shipping. The problem is to secure the most effective utilization of a very scarce and highly strategic commodity. Third, we will need joint measures regarding exchange rates and prices. Collaboration is necessary to prevent separate national controls from working at cross purposes. Fourth, what about financial arrangements? Includes lease, lend, bookkeeping, loans, other such matters. The fundamental problem is the determination of the bases on which the costs of war equipment are ultimately to be apportioned among the collaborating countries. Fifth, joint measures of economic warfare, including, for example, collaboration in enforcing boycotts against blacklisted firms, collaboration in withholding fuel and supplies from ships likely to engage in blockade running, collaboration in buying up supplies of strategic commodities which might otherwise reach the enemy, pooling of economic information concerning enemy countries with a view to the selection of targets for industrial bombing. Six, joint measures affecting orphaned colonies. Seventh, collaboration in proposing and carrying through economic aspects of a peace arrangement with an isolated and defeated partner, or in redeemed territory with an isolated and defeated Axis partner, or in redeemed territory. It is evident that the wartime tasks listed differ considerably from the peacetime tasks listed previously. And yet there are points at which the techniques and the organizations developed could carry over with proper modifications, of course. Treasury experts who collaborate in wartime on exchange and currency measures can probably adapt many of their joint procedures to the conditions of peace. Wartime shipping control designed to conserve tonnage and to prevent vessels from carrying goods to the enemy may also be important in the immediate post-war period when transport space will have to be allocated for carrying foodstuffs and raw materials to Europe and other shortage areas. Joint supply committees which handle military goods in wartime may be the best channel for organizing emergency distribution of materials and equipment in newly redeemed territory. The really big problem in converting wartime collaboration into peacetime collaboration, however, does not lie in the technical realm at all. What was lacking after the First World War was unity of purpose. The Allied and associated powers were able to achieve and maintain a certain unity of purpose so long as they were confronted by the menace of a common enemy, though the menace of defeat had to become very strong indeed before they finally adopted a unified military command. When the war ended, World War I, of course, bonds of unity snapped almost at once. As a result, none of the technical collaboration on shipping, supply, and other matters that had developed during the war actually carried over into the peacetime. One of the most interesting documents on the development of Allied collaboration during the First World War was the report of General Tasker H. Bliss, military representative of the United States on the Supreme War Council. Now, it's located in the Lansing Papers, Volume 2. General Bliss at first believed that the Supreme War Council ought to be composed of the military commanders-in-chief, the professional experts, who would elaborate a common plan of action. Later, he saw that the primary need was more fundamental, a unified purpose, a unity of will. Unity of this sort could be attained only by bringing the high political leaders together for joint decisions so that separate national preoccupations could be subordinated to a clearer view of the common task. And so, to some degree, we wound up with this help wanted sign. A will to unity was what was wanted. Economic collaboration as well must be based fundamentally on such psychological unity. The tendency of allies and our friends over the years to fall out among ourselves is notorious. The purposes regarding which unity has to be achieved in time of peace are vastly different from those of wartime. Oh, certainly they ought to be. It would be, you see, disastrous if post-war economic collaboration should consist of measures of continued economic warfare against Germany, Italy, Japan. This was the type of post-war economic collaboration actually contemplated at an Allied conference held in 1916. Well, Bennett, why do you share with us this history that goes back nearly 100 years ago? In a few moments, we'll divulge to you why. Among democratic countries, little can be done toward carrying wartime collaboration into the post-war period unless there is strong public acceptance of the desirability of continued collaboration. Such public acceptance can hardly be founded on reason alone. You see, common symbols, feelings, attitudes, loyalties are most important in politics. 1 ounce of effective political symbolism accepted by influential groups and by people generally is likely to be worth a pound of technical collaboration, acts of union, common declarations and charters, supranational legislative assemblies chosen in part by direct vote of the people or by functional groups instead of exclusively by national governments. Supranational executives so set up as to be able to win loyalty and support for themselves rather than to the separate governments that create them. All these things have great importance. The techniques of gradualism depend for their success on the development of unity under the influence of successive acts of practical collaborations, but they may break down because of a lack of symbolic unity. It is a great error, though one very commonly made, to underestimate the importance of political structure as one of the factors determining the substance of economic and other policies. Political machinery is not merely a means of executing a common will that already exists. It is also a means of forming a common will. A strong case can therefore be made for the view that wartime technical collaboration can hardly be made to carry over effectively into the peace unless it can be reinforced at some stage by a symbolic act of union. The creation of a league or a federation, and by some sort of machinery for facilitating the achievement as well as the execution of a unified will. The governments collaborating against the Axis, that of course was our enemy during World War II. The governments collaborating against the Axis should start now to combat the pessimism regarding post-war economic prospects, which is so widespread among common people, as well as among businesses and labor leaders. It should be pointed out that given proper organization and the determination to act in concert, it will be possible to have an expanding, developing world economy with jobs for all and with constantly rising standards of living after the war. The destruction of modern war is very great, but so are the recuperative powers of the modern economy. If it can be made to operate at anywhere near full capacity. Perhaps the prime requisite for reasonably successful political and social economic adjustments after the war, and hence for a durable peace, is that we have a post-war expanding economy. It is possible to maintain an expanding economy. The crucial factor is the rate of real investment, which must be kept sufficiently high. Real investment means new factories, new highways, new housing, new capital equipment generally. What is sufficiently high depends upon the habits of the community as to savings and consumption. If automatic market forces after the war do not keep private real investment up to the level necessary for stability at reasonably full employment, and it is unlikely that we can count on this, then public agencies, both national and supranational, must not hesitate to take vigorous action. Defense programs in all the leading countries have shown the people that governments can bring full employment by investing enough in destructive equipment. It is unlikely that public opinion after the war will accept the view that it is impossible to accomplish the same thing in peacetime by more constructive means, such as subsidized housing, the planned industrialization of new regions, deliberate efforts to increase consumption through shorter hours, social security benefits, improvement of nutrition, and the like. And here, then, is the main economic task of the post-war period. On the test of success or failure in accomplishing this task may hang the fate not only of collaborating among United Nations for winning the peace, but the fate of democratic regimes as well. Eugene Staley, April 1942. I'll return.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance.
Well, at some point during the first 30-35 minutes of today's episode of Dawn of the Dead, one had to be asking what in the world we were talking about. Well, even as with authors of the caliber, Mr. Staley, who most certainly was pushing and recommending us toward a United Nations, there was some goodness and some intelligence in some of the words he said. My concern, of course, is all putting us under the control of this august body and giving them all this bloody omnipotence that they seem to think they must have. In Chapter 5, we're going to talk about the United Nations grab on our private property, our lands, etc. But a lot of Mr. Staley's talk, and I don't know if you heard properly when I closed that segment, that piece was written by Eugene Staley in April 1942. That's 60 years ago, and also 3 years before the actual advent of this body we now call the United Nations. There, of course, had been attempts under the Woodrow Wilson administration to cram us down to the League of Nations. Well, that didn't fly. So they had to come after us in another fashion. NATO, the bastard stepchild of the UN. And as Linda Ellerbee says, and so it goes. One small step at a time, these advocates of global government are pushing schemes for global taxation as part of the plan to mold these United Nations into a world government. So you think you pay enough taxes, don't you? That your crippling tax liabilities to local, state, and federal government can't possibly get any higher? That the voracious appetite of Leviathan can't possibly defy political gravity anymore? That maybe liberal tax and spend policies have finally been discredited? Guess again, my friends. There's a new frontier of creative taxation these days that has big government hucksters in a lather of anticipation. International taxation. From taxes on international currency transactions to taxes on carbon emissions in emails, global taxation schemes, they're all the rage in the halls of the United Nations and the various think tanks that advise them. Global taxation isn't an entirely new idea, you see. Vague proposals have been floated by internationalist utopians since the late 19th century. That's the 1800s, folks. Like other aspects of the drive to a new world order, however, global taxation has been a back burner issue, at least until somewhat recently. Let me, before we talk a bit about the Tobin tax, I want to ask you a few questions. Let's try to make this simple. When you pay your taxes, be it monthly, quarterly, whatever, annually, do you think the money goes to operate the federal government, the United States of America's federal government? Is that what you've been led to believe? Well, you're wrong. You make the check out to the Internal Revenue Service, a private corporation. But who endorses that check? The Internal Revenue, of course, right? I mean, that's who I made the check out to. I mean, make a check out to Kmart and go to Walmart and try to cash it. Doesn't work, does it? Look at the back of the check when you get it back after paying your pound of flesh. See who got the money? It wasn't the Internal Revenue Service. It was the Federal Reserve Bank, Incorporated, another private corporation. Well, gee, that would tend to let me believe that the Internal Revenue Service is nothing more than a collection agency for the Federal Reserve Bank. Aha, you'd be right. But then, that money goes to Uncle Sam, doesn't it? No, folks, wrong again. It goes to the Governor, Secretary of the Treasury of the International Monetary Fund, Incorporated, another bastard stepchild of the United Nations. Now, doesn't that make you proud? You paid your taxes to help run the United States, didn't you? But you gave your hard-earned money to the United Nations, a worldwide socialist communist organization. That's right. You worked a year and paid your taxes to support communism. Now, the first and most concrete proposal for worldwide taxation was advanced by Yale economist James Tobin back in the 1970s. Ooh, Liberalville, USA. Decrying the destabilization effects of what he called excessive international mobility of private financial capital, Tobin proposed a uniform worldwide levy on international currency exchanges. It was called the Tobin tax. It was intended to throw some sand in the wheels of our excessively efficient international money markets and to pave the way for an eventual common currency, common monetary and fiscal policy, economic integration. Wow. Tobin, in the 70s, must have been reading Staley of the 40s. And although the proponents of the Tobin tax can't quite agree on how such a tax might be implemented, the proposal has continued to attract admiring attention from the internationalist set, especially since the financial crises in Mexico, Asia, Brazil, and Russia in the 1990s, and old son of a gun, we're facing it all over again, Japan, Argentina. As Enron goes, so goes the country. Currency instability has bedeviled international commerce since the abandonment of the international gold standard and the adoption of these so-called floating exchange rates. in the context of a global system of fiat currencies, currency speculation is the free market's way of penalizing central banks that inflate too irresponsibly, that is. In other words, create too much money out of thin air. As Tobin lamented back then, the stimulus of expansionary monetary policy to domestic demand is limited by the competition of foreign interest rates for mobile funds. Because private free market currency trading provides a check on the near absolute power of central bankers. It has been targeted for heavy taxation by the globalist cartel. The Tobin tax could be seen as a form of sin tax. No, not S-Y-N, but S-I-N. Kind of like you go to the whorehouse and the sin here being currency, market, speculation. Those words from Tobin proponent Thomas Paley, the assistant director of policy for the AFL-CIO. People bright enough to profit from activities as arcane as international currency speculation, well, they might find ways to avoid a Tobin tax. They might, for instance, invent entirely new financial instruments. Such possibilities worry would-be global tax inquisitors. To remedy this, Paley envisions an endless regime of regulatory innovation to stay abreast of the international currency markets. Over time, the financial markets would undoubtedly innovate in directions that evade a Tobin tax, but this does not invalidate the Tobin tax. Instead, it affirms the fact that regulation is an ongoing process, a dynamic game played between regulators and the regulated, we being the regulated. Those needs to be continually updated, of course. Sometimes regulators manage to get ahead of the game, and other times they just manage to stay even. Still other times they just get. However, there is never an excuse for capitulating and surrendering the public interest to the dictates of market. How could such a tax scheme be implemented? If it were done unilaterally by countries like the United States to set the example for everyone else, currency traders would simply shift to those countries free of the tax. Nevertheless, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research has proposed that the United States take the lead in self-imposing the Tobin tax in some form. He states, as a result of its unmatched economic and military power, the United States, of course, can usually force the rest of the world to accommodate its concerns. If the United States sought to use its power in international forums to promote a speculation tax, it's likely that it could succeed. In his original proposal, Tobin suggested that the role of tax collector be played by either the IMF or the World Bank. Modern versions of the plan call for the creation of an entirely new tax collection bureaucracy. In either case, the final beneficiary would be the embryonic United Nations-centered world government. For most of us, international currency exchanges are not a daily concern. Punishing the George Soroses of the world might seem long overdue, but the globalists, they have no intention of confining taxation to a few super-rich international financiers. Since Tobin's proposal, the move to find global sources of tax revenue has gained considerable momentum. The focus has shifted to the more mundane activities of you and I, the middle classes. The radical environmental movement has recently thrown its weight behind various global taxation schemes. The so-called carbon tax is a prominent example. Exploiting concerns over global warming, the carbon tax would punish alleged contributors to global warming by increasing the price of fossil fuels proportionate to their carbon content. The aim of such a tax would not only be to raise revenues for globalist projects, but also to coerce industrialized nations to knuckle under to the megalomaniacal objectives of the radical environmental lobby. It isn't easy being green. Reflecting on the unlimited possibilities of such a tax, Richard Cooper, Harvard professor of international economics, writing in a recent issue of Foreign Affairs, a CFR publication, of course, enthused the tax would boost general conservation of fossil fuels. Economic growth could be encouraged by reducing other taxes, like those on foreign trade and earnings. Taxes on fossil fuel would, of course, have some undesirable effects, such as delaying the switch from firewood to fossil fuels in poor countries. But it would be impractical in most cases to tax firewood. In principle, it would be possible to extend the idea of a common carbon tax to methane as well. Keep the chickens out of the coop. Covering wetland rice production, decomposable refuse, gas pipeline losses, cattle raising. That more difficult step could be phased in later. Oh, I'm certain it could be. In other words, my friends, no level of taxation on human activity would satisfy those who regard the human race as a blemish on the surface of Mother Earth. And of course, Cooper recommends that the international community, embodied within the UN, be the recipient of any such environmental taxation proceeds. Also attracting a lot of attention for the same reason as the carbon tax is proposed tax on aviation fuel to penalize jet planes for their emission of supposedly harmful carbon dioxide. Both carbon and aviation fuel taxes are transparently motivated by pseudo-scientific solicitude for the global environment and their attempts to achieve via taxation some of the major aims of the Kyoto Treaty on global warming. A treaty that I pray God, as of this recording, I believe is now a defunct deal. But nor will the global taxation bandwagon stop with the specialized imposts on currency traders and environmental polluters. Still more recent proposals contemplate taxing international internet activity, especially overseas emails. Once taxes such as these are enacted, can a global income tax be far behind? An astonishingly candid article by Kevin Bomart of the UN-affiliated Global Policy Forum outlines the deceptive strategies used by proponents of global taxation. The process, the letter begins, of implementing global levies will necessarily be slow and incremental. There's that word, incremental. I love that. Thus, it is important to take these small incremental steps now so that larger ones are possible in the future. Starting small means that tax proposals can begin with small percentages levied at the local or state level. Increasing the boldness and scale of the tax are secondary steps. Low rates are less politically daunting. Deciding on tax rates will be an iterated process. And as scientific and economic understanding increases, tax rates can be adjusted. The first challenge is to get the tax implemented. Pointing out that state and national level initiatives face less formidable obstacles than their global counterparts, Bomart then recommends that precedents for measures like the carbon tax be set at the local level. Citing examples of carbon tax proposals in Minnesota and various European nations, although what Minnesota and various European nations have in common, I can't quite understand. Bomart encourages activists to push for what will be, quote, necessary intermediate steps that can set important examples, end quote. Bomart also recommends deliberately misleading rhetoric in the propaganda campaign on behalf of global taxation, where he says the very word tax is loaded with negative connotations and is often synonymous with political death. For this reason, he says, Couching proposals in terms of a fee, a levy, or a charge will be decidedly more palatable to policymakers. A charge or user fee, in fact, makes more sense in the context of placing restrictions on the use of global commons, such as air, sea, electronic frequencies, spaces in orbit, etc., because it is the opposite of free, the current cost. My friends, if you think the air that you breathe is free, think again. As Balmart has made abundantly clear, the globalist cartel hopes to tax every conceivable human activity since, by definition, the global commons belongs to and must be administered by them. By slow incremental steps, the patient gradualism of which the architects of world order are so fond, we are to be shackled to a regime of heavy, arbitrarily defined international taxation for which the sky is literally no limit. The blue sky is literally no limit. And by exploiting radical initiatives at local levels and using carefully coordinated talking points and weasel words, globalists intend to foist upon us a brave new world of tax and spend on a scale that will make us yearn for the good old days. The Internal Revenue Service. It is interesting, as I emphasize the word blue sky. Why do I do that? Well, obviously, one must only look upon the color of the flag of the United Nations. And somewhat brought to my attention some time ago that, and I recall this from the days of my youth when I attended Presbyterian Church, the colors blue and yellow were quite symbolic in Christianity. Do you think that it was by accident that the United Nations chose that same color blue to be their banner? Psychological complexities foisted upon the world, such as they have never known. The United Nations chose the same color blue to foist their global approaches on us, trying to confuse the Christians of the world. We come to the conclusion of chapter 4 of our series, Dawn of the Dead in the Clutches of the United Nations. Listen closely to the words of Steve Voss. I hope to see you again without apology. I am Jeffrey Bennett.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleam? Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming and the rock. Say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the
time to play ball. Are you ready to join my team?
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast 2-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
Have you ever needed to make a phone call but didn't want the person you're calling to know that it was you on the other end? Have you ever needed to make a call and wanted to keep your phone number and location private? Well, now you can with PatriotPhone.com. PatriotPhone.com will enable you to make unlimited calls anonymously. That's right, unlimited anonymous phone calls to anywhere in the U.S. and 36 countries around the world. Our most popular phone plan includes unlimited calls, your own phone number, voicemail, call forwarding, and many other great features. Visit PatriotPhone.com to get your own phone number in any state and take back control of your phone calls. PatriotPhone.com also allows you to record your calls and access all of your phone records online. PatriotPhone.com works with iPhones, Android-based phones, and Windows computers. Protect your privacy and your freedom with unlimited anonymous telephone service from PatriotPhone.com. Today, that's PatriotPhone.com.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast 2-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.